You're listening to episode 18 of the Allan Gray Podcast. I'm Grant Pitt, Head of Institutional at Allan Gray, and your host for this episode. Frontier markets are often overlooked and misunderstood, leading many investors to shy away from them completely. But despite the challenges and risks usually associated with these markets, they provide an extremely exciting hunting ground for adventurous long-term investors and can prove incredibly rewarding for those who manage the risks carefully and pick winning stocks. To explore some of the themes shaping frontier markets and explain how we approach them at Allan Gray, I'm joined by the two portfolio managers of the Allan Gray Frontier Markets Equity Fund, Rory Kutiska-Jacobson and Varshan Maharaj. Rory has been at Allan Gray for over 16 years, and in addition to managing frontier equities, also manages South African equities, African equities, domestic and global balance mandates for clients. He's also no stranger to the Allan Gray podcast, having been on it on four previous occasions. Varshan, on the other hand, like me, is a newbie to the podcast, with this being his first appearance. So perhaps let's start with you, Varshan. Could you just give our listeners an overview of how you became an investment analyst at Allan Gray and now portfolio manager?
So my interest in investing and shares is really an interest in studying businesses. And if I had to draw it back, it probably developed in my childhood through two key ways. The first is that my dad runs a small auditing practice in Durban, and I spent a lot of time around him and his clients, and most of the discussions would be around businesses, what makes a business good or bad, and overcoming various struggles in his clients' businesses. And the second would be when I was 10 or 11 years old, I joined a golf club, and most of the members were small business owners. So I would spend the whole day with three or more people talking about golf to a small extent, and to a large extent, their business and challenges and opportunities. So that's really how I developed my interest in business. And it sort of flowed naturally into a curiosity about shares.
As highlighted earlier, Rory, you manage various Allan Gray funds, but you started managing clients' capital in the frontier markets when we launched the Frontier Fund in 2017. So I presume frontier markets are pretty close to your heart. Perhaps you can just give us an overview. We know what developed markets are, we know what emerging markets, but what countries are included in the frontier markets and how large is your investment universe?
I like to think of the Frontier Fund as my first child, given that I've been with it since inception. So what is a frontier market? There's no definitive classification of a frontier market, but in simplistic terms, it's most of the countries that are slightly less developed than emerging markets. We tend to anchor towards the MSCI classification of what is a frontier market. And when they look at kind of determining what is a frontier market versus a emerging market, they look at the economic development of the country, the size of the publicly listed equity market, and then the depth and liquidity of that market. In addition to that, they also have some subjective criteria where they look at how kind of accessible the market is, how open it is to foreign investors, which does introduce some unpredictability into the equation. And you do get some weird idiosyncrasies. For example, Iceland is in our universe, which I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily anticipate. And to make it even more complicated, our particular fund, we anchor towards the MSCI Frontier Emerging Market Index, which includes a handful of the smaller emerging market countries, notably Peru, Colombia, Egypt, the Philippines.
So, I mean, from an investable universe size, how large is the investment universe?
It's well over 1,000 companies, depending on which market you look at. I mean, in terms of potential and capacity, it's huge over the fullness of time. And the reason I say that is, I mean, many of these countries are not as well developed as some of the more recognized markets, but they have very large populations with very kind of high ambitions. And the level of kind of formalization in those economies are 10, 15, 20 years behind where you might see in Western Europe or the US. But with the fullness of time, one would expect them to develop quite significantly. So, you know, investable universe, I'd say it's around 3,500, 4,000 shares of reasonable size across all of the geographies. And the average company kind of we look at is anything from kind of $40, $50 million in size to well over $1 billion.
Putting that in context, the South African market, we've got probably less than 200 shares. So over 3,500, 4,000 that you highlight. How do you go about choosing which companies to research and invest in client capital in particular companies, Varshan?
So as a starting point, we know that in every country, good businesses earn great returns and poor businesses destroy shareholder value. And we also know that in many markets over many time periods, the entire market return can be explained by a few good companies. So using this knowledge, when we do our screening, we look for companies that have a long track record of growing their earnings per share in US dollars and companies that are very profitable when we look at metrics such as operating margins, return on capital, return on equity, and so on. We use that to get a short list of companies, and then we study the companies closer to get a better understanding of what enabled them to grow those earnings and earn those good returns. And we make an assessment whether they are likely to continue doing that in future. We also apply our minds to think about the runway to grow. So is this company at maturity or does it still have a long way to grow its earnings? And over a period of time, we've been able to build our knowledge of which industries are attractive in which countries, and we continue to develop that as we go forward. And we also look at cyclical companies, trying to find companies that are near the bottom of their cycles, because that's generally a good time to invest.
I think it's fair to say that there's a number of high-performing companies that we're likely to miss, and that's not a tragedy. I mean, what are we trying to do? What are we trying to achieve with the Frontier Fund? Is we're looking to find 15, 20, 25 really high-quality investments that you can own over 5, 6, or 10 years. And of course, we're going to make mistakes, but if you can get 7, 8 out of those right and you can hold them for a reasonable period of time, I think you can generate really good returns in these markets. And I think what makes frontier markets particularly attractive to kind of Allen Gray and our way of investing is, if you think about like the genesis of Allen Gray, you know, we're active managers looking for inefficiencies in the market. Inefficiency is another way of saying a mispricing. So you're looking for assets that are materially mispriced relative to the true value. And I think what's particularly nice about frontier markets, as Varshan was alluding to, is you can do deep level kind of fundamental research in arguably far less competitive markets where far fewer people are doing that level of research. And Howard Marks likes to say, you know, market efficiencies come from two things, prejudice and ignorance. And I think those are particularly prevalent in the frontier world.
So highlighting a quote, in preparation for the podcast, I read through some of the previous quarterly strategy papers on frontier markets. So just to put that in context, we obviously build the portfolios from the bottom up, do detailed research reports on particular companies which get discussed, debated, and then voted on. But then on a quarterly basis, we flip it around and look at the various asset classes and markets. And in your recent Frontier Markets quarterly strategy paper, I noted the quote by Alan Meacham, Varshan, "We buy stocks the way we buy toilet paper, high quality, on sale, and in bulk sizes." Is that true for the frontier market? And if so, what characteristics are you looking for in kind of quality companies?
I didn't think that anyone outside the company would see that, but I thought
Grant's sharing our proprietary information.
I thought it was a good quote to get to the crux of what we look for. But if I had to flesh out the sort of characteristics that we want in companies that we buy, I would say firstly, we would want a high level of insider ownership, ownership by the management team, because that provides alignment with shareholders. As I mentioned earlier, we want companies that have a long history of growing their earnings per share in US dollars. We look at everything in US dollars, so it makes companies in different countries comparable and with a long runway to grow. And we want profitable companies. And what makes a profitable company? Often it's companies that are operating with a good market structure. When I say that, I mean, there's not a very high level of competition. Ideally, you would want a duopoly or oligopoly with not much new capital coming into the market. And ESG is a big consideration in the way we invest. So we look at governance as well. And it's a relative call. As Rory mentioned, many of these companies are still in the early stages of their development. Governance is still developing as they go along. So we want to own a basket of companies that have strong operating positions and operate in jurisdictions where the rule of law is upheld and property rights are upheld.
Great. I guess you touched on an important point there, the management teams and skin in the game. But meeting those management teams is understandably far more difficult given the geographical footprint of the frontier markets. And yet you both do travel to meet these management teams. Are you able to share any interesting insights from your travels, learnings from these meeting these management teams?
Yeah, so I mean, it is a challenge. And I guess one of the idiosyncrasies of being based in South Africa with a South African passport, it's an additional challenge in that every time you have to visit one of these countries, by and large, you have to get a visa. And the visa requirements can at times be quite onerous for a surprising number of small countries. But once you have your visa, we typically try to travel kind of 2, 3, 4 times a year each. I think it's really important to at least visit these markets once or twice every few years to get an understanding of what's the culture like on the ground, to kind of see how things operate. And we'll typically, you know, have a relatively concentrated agenda where if it's a conference, you'll be seeing 6, 7 companies a day. If it's an organized trip where you're going to actually the company's offices, we'll typically probably, depending on the economy, see between 3 and 5 companies a day. And try in total in a trip, you'll try to kind of see 15 to 20 companies. So, and we'll do that within a week. So relatively concentrated trips. But to get a good idea of kind of what's happening on the ground, how people in those markets think and operate. And I think also coming from South Africa, I think we've also got a slight advantage in that we've grown up in an emerging market ourselves. We've got a good understanding of how kind of some of these challenges in some of these less developed markets are navigated by formal companies. In terms of anecdotes, I mean, I've had some fantastic trips, but things that kind of stand out, which are less relevant to investment cases per se. But I mean, when I was in Pakistan, I would say 2 out of 3 corporates wanted to chat about cricket. So the first 15, 20 minutes of each management discussion was actually more about cricket than about what was happening at their businesses. And at the extreme, the one guy I met, we spoke for well over an hour, but the first hour was entirely on South African cricket and which wineries he wanted to go to in the vineyards.
If I could add to that, generally when we meet these companies, we get to spend 45 minutes to an hour with the CEO and CFO. And the sort of questions we ask are generally to get a sense of how the management thinks about capital allocation. So what that means is within their business, they generate an amount of cash flow. And we're trying to see how management think about whether they're going to use that money to pay out dividends, to make acquisitions, to repay debt, and so on. And also to get a sense of what's their plans for growth for the business and the business's prospects. We also sometimes find out about unique laws in each country. For example, in Pakistan and Kuwait, they have some peculiarities on the way share buybacks work. And in terms of anecdotes, one of the companies that we own in our fund is a company called John Keels in Sri Lanka, where we've been shareholders for a number of years. And if I cast my mind back to 2020, when I started co-managing the fund with Rory, whenever I spoke to the FD of John Keels, I would always ask him for an update on his load shedding situation and how many hours a day he has power and whether it's constraining his ability to operate. And in our more recent conversations, it's completely flipped around. So he asked me about our load shedding situation and whether we are able to operate. And another thing about visiting these markets is a lot of the frontier currencies have been weak against the US dollar in recent years, and many locals are skeptical about keeping their savings in US dollars. And when I was in Sri Lanka recently, even the tuk-tuk drivers were quoting me prices in US dollars. So a tuk-tuk is sort of like an auto rickshaw. So everyone's got their mind on currency and value in these markets.
The other nice thing about visiting these companies is you also get a sense of how management thinks about who the company belongs to, whether it's shareholders or the management team. And so at times you can visit a management team and there's 4 or 5 people or rooms you have to go through before you actually get to meet the management team. And it's like this palatial estate is the head office. And at other times, I mean, I've had board meetings in the hallway where like the board table is set up between the reception desk and the elevator. And it should maybe come as no surprise that the returns from the latter company has been much better than the former company.
Thinking about things in dollar terms is the right way to do it. But you obviously face significant currency risk investing in various countries. And we've seen material depreciation across particular frontier currencies. Think of the Sri Lankan rupee in 2022. Last year, we saw the Egyptian pound, the Nigerian naira, both devaluing significantly. So how do you think about investing in companies when faced with significant currency risk?
We try and make an assessment of the fair value of the currency versus the US dollar. And we would consider things like purchasing power parity, also inflation differentials and interest rate differentials. We even look at non-traditional measures such as the Big Mac Index. And we supplement this with a qualitative overlay. We bear in mind that there's a fairly high degree of persistency in currencies which tend to perform well and those which tend to perform weaker. For example, the Ghanaian cedi sort of depreciates at a fairly constant rate versus the dollar. So we would be circumspect investing in a Ghanaian stock. We would want very strong growth in local currency in order to compensate for that. And when we analyze companies, we have a very close look at what percent of their operating expenses and CapEx is denominated in dollars. We're also very wary of companies that have their debt denominated in dollars, if all their revenue is denominated in local currency. So we sort of try to avoid that mismatch.
I think that last point that Varshan made is probably the most important, in the sense that we very much try and understand how the local currency and or a material change in the exchange rate can impact that particular company. And different companies have different kind of gearing to the exchange rate. And then the other thing just to highlight is, you know, if you were investing in Europe or Japan or Australia and you have a view on the currency, you can hedge that view. So if you think the currency is particularly attractive or unattractive, you can use currency hedging to lock in and go short or long that currency. The reality is, in frontier markets, by and large, with rare exception, it's prohibitively expensive to hedge. And so when we're looking at these markets, as Varshan alluded to, we primarily kind of anchor towards inflation or interest rate differentials. We also look at how the macro is managed at a fiscal level. So to the extent that the government is running a deficit or a surplus, and unless there's a material reason to be confident in a view on currency, I mean, I actually think generally currencies are very hard to call. So unless you've seen a significant dislocation, it can be very challenging.
That's a key point there. I think currency moves can be counterintuitive. You take the Jordan lari, which in early 2022 actually strengthened despite unrest in Kazakhstan and Russia invading Ukraine. So just from a kind of a geopolitical macro kind of perspective, how do you guys consider those macro factors when thinking of investing in particular countries and companies?
So that's a great example, I guess, and it's got particular reference to our fund. And I'm going to preempt it by saying you never want to profit from war. But I think we were actually quite lucky in the sense that we didn't foresee the invasion coming at all. We're not very good at predicting macro events or major geopolitical tensions, but we already had quite meaningful positions in both Georgia and Kazakhstan, primarily in the banks. So we'd done research on those companies. We liked the companies. We had positions. Then Russia invaded Ukraine towards the end of February 2022. Immediately thereafter, those markets were hit incredibly hard. So obviously Russia sold off materially, but almost every geographically close country also sold off. So within the space of a week or two, you saw the banks we own, so primarily TBC Bank, which is a Georgian bank, and Halyk Bank, which is the largest bank in Kazakhstan, they were down 30 to 40% in dollars within a week. And, you know, panic kind of sets in, and maybe the natural human inclination would be to sell and say, get me out. We did the opposite. So we looked at these companies. As I said, we knew them relatively well already, and we made some kind of broad assumptions. So we said, look, let's assume this is a pretty dire macro environment. You know, the economy is going to be down 5 to 10%, and the banks are geared to the economy, so maybe your bank earnings fall 25, 30%. But then the share prices were also already down 30, 40% in US dollars, and we thought they were cheap before. Here you have a situation where the market has sold off aggressively, and what are the dominant banks in these markets are trading on, you know, 2 to 4 times earnings. And even if you make some relatively conservative assumptions on a look-forward basis, maybe you're paying 5 to 6 times earnings, but those are depressed earnings. And then we would also take a view on the currency and say, well, let's assume, you know, the currency weakens 5, 10, 15%. If you look forward 4 years, you know, if things just normalize, you can get a decent return out of these markets over that investment horizon. As it so happens, it actually turned out to be a bonanza, in particularly for Georgia. So what you've seen happen is a lot of regional trade flow has been redirected through both those markets. And in Georgia, which is actually quite a small country of around 4 million people, there's been a huge influx of Russians and Ukrainians trying to avoid the war into their market. and that's driven their GDP quite healthily. So actually, Georgia's had very strong GDP growth over the last 2 years. And rather than the bank's earnings fall in both those markets, bank earnings have been up 15, 20, 25%. And the currencies have strengthened. So you had a situation where equities sold off, but actually the underlying fundamentals have been fantastic. As much as we bottom-up fundamental analysts, we don't ignore the macro, but we think about the macro in terms of how it impacts that particular company or industry, and that extends to the currency as well. And maybe just touching on geopolitics, I mean, so in-country politics is far from our speciality. We don't have any particular insight into who will win the upcoming election, if there is one, and what that'll mean for the country. What we focus on a lot is respect for property rights and the history within that country in terms of how it has performed through other election cycles.
Any currencies that concern you today in terms of markets that you're investing in? As I said, we've seen significant depreciation across multiple kind of countries.
I would say we're generally skeptical of any currency that's pegged to the US dollar. The same countries over time which tend to be vulnerable to depreciation against the dollar. And those would include currencies such as the Egyptian pound, the Kenyan shilling, the Ghanaian cedi, and the Nigerian naira, and also the Argentinian peso.
That doesn't preclude us from investing in those markets. So if you look at our fund, we've got around 7% in Nigeria, and that's primarily in a handful of the larger Nigerian banks. So we may have a negative view on the naira, we think that's more than discounted into the domestic share prices.
So as Rory discussed, we're very focused on bottom-up research and company fundamentals. And maybe to give an example of how we consider the narrative and try and translate it into numbers is over the last sort of few years, there's been growing tensions between the US and China, and that's led many companies to do less production in China and more production in other countries such as Vietnam, which is in our index. So we consider how those sort of shifts of production to Vietnam will improve the growth prospects of companies in the universe, and we make an estimate of how that's going to affect their revenue and earnings, and then we compare that to the share prices when we make our buy and sell decisions.
Just on that, we'll get to Vietnam, but maybe the kind of overweight exposure you've touched on, Georgian banks. So I see a significant overweight to Georgia that has been reduced to a certain extent, but also Kazakhstan. What's the interest in particular investment opportunities in Kazakhstan?
We have two shares in Kazakhstan. The one is a bank named Halyk, and the one is a uranium miner named Kazatomprom. Rory, maybe you would like to speak about Halyk first.
So Halyk is the largest bank in Kazakhstan. They've got around 35% market share, depending on how you measure it. And it's really an oligopoly in the sense that there's Halyk, and then there's a much newer bank called Kaspi, which I also think is a really good company. But Halyk trades at a much bigger discount to Kaspi, and both have been growing strongly in the current environment. And if you look at kind of the depth of formal banking penetration in Kazakhstan, it's decades behind what we see in the developed world. So I think the prospects for growth over the next 5, 10, 15 years remain very high. And here you're kind of finding a well-capitalized, well-run bank trading on kind of less than 4x historic earnings.
So on Kazatomprom, it illustrates one of the opportunities that frontier markets provide, which is access to a broader opportunity set. We think that uranium is a very attractive commodity to invest in currently. And if you're only restricted to the JSE, your only option to get exposure would be to buy shares in BHP, which has a 6% market share of mined uranium, whereas Kazatomprom has a 23% market share. But within the broader context of BHP, uranium is a very small contribution to earnings. And even if the uranium price doubled, you wouldn't benefit much as a BHP shareholder. Whereas through Kazatomprom, you're getting direct and geared uranium exposure. And with any commodity, we're looking at the supply and demand fundamentals going forward to see how attractive it is. And going forward, we think the demand for uranium is going to increase materially as many countries have sort of changed their positioning on nuclear power. It's sort of seen as a key source of energy going forward. And on the supply side, we've seen supply disruptions in Canada and Kazakhstan, which are the two main producing countries for uranium. So we expect deficits going forward and a much stronger uranium price, which should translate into strong earnings growth for Kazatomprom.
And then I guess the kicker is that they're also the lowest cost producer. So even if it transpires that the uranium price isn't as healthy as we anticipate, they should be able to comfortably earn a decent return through the cycle.
The other big country exposure I note in the fund is the Philippines. So it's 18% of fund, albeit, you know, it's 24% of the benchmark weighting. What do you find attractive about Filipino opportunities? Any kind of companies that you can provide insights in terms of that are held in the fund?
So I think the Philippines is one of the markets where we've got a greater kind of weighting towards consumer-facing companies. One of our biggest positions is in Pure Gold Price Club, which is one of the largest grocery retailer in the Philippines. And they're growing. I mean, formal retail penetration probably isn't growing as fast as we'd necessarily like in the Philippines. And I think one of the challenges is it's a country that's a collection of islands, really. So I think actually logistically supplying a number of those islands outside of Manila is more challenging than we probably would have anticipated 4, 5, 6 years ago. But nonetheless, so Pure Gold Price Club is one of the largest formal grocery retailers, growing at kind of 8 to 12% per annum. Earnings in terms of the margin or the return that they make on the goods they sell are not high. And you're buying that on a single-digit multiple, which I think is very attractive. We also own that through a conglomerate called Costco, which has a significant share in Pure Gold. In addition to that, it has a number of other smaller businesses in the Philippines, but it trades at a material discount to Pure Gold. So effectively, you're buying just at stake in Pure Gold at a discount to the Costco share price, and then you can get a handful of the other businesses to which they're exposed for free. The other one that has been a big winner for the fund over time is a company called Ginebra San Miguel, which is a gin producer in the Philippines. And we first invested in Ginebra around 2018, 2019. And it's grown, so, you know, the share price is up 4 or 5 times, earnings have grown at a similar rate. And despite that, it still trades on a reasonable multiple. So on the most recent earnings, it's on around 8 times earnings. So we've kind of maintained or slightly trimmed our position, but we haven't sold.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have put gin as a drink of choice in the Philippines, but it sounds like it's growing well. Coming back to your point on Vietnam and shifting production from China to various other markets, I note that there still is a material underweight position to Vietnam and Peru. So 14% relative underweight versus its weight in the benchmark to Vietnam and 12% to Peru. Why are you cautious on those particular markets at this point?
The narrative is bullish in the longer term. But if you look in the shorter term, Vietnam has had significant challenges in 2023. For most of the company's earnings reported, volumes were down 10% year on year in financial year 2023, and that's due to a number of factors. Some of them include their main trading partners, which are the US, Europe, Korea, and Japan. Demand was quite weak in those places during 2023. Another factor is there was a strong anti-corruption clampdown by government, especially in the real estate sector, and that had a big impact on consumer confidence and spending. And many of the property developers were not able to raise funds during 2023 due to new requirements that were added on bond issuance in September 2022. And interest rates had gone up a lot, so consumers had less disposable income, and all of that translated into lower earnings growth in 2023. But we did use that as an opportunity to pick up shares that we found attractive. For example, Masan Consumer was a share that we bought in 2023, and it's been a very strong performer. I think trailing 12 months to March 2023, it returned over 100% in dollars. So as you mentioned, we are underweight Vietnam, but we are looking for pockets of opportunity and trying to take advantage of that for our clients.
Varshan made some great points. It all comes down to valuation. So I think if you wanted to, you can paint a fantastic story for Vietnam, you know, population of around 100 million people, very productive, hardworking people, young population, benefiting a lot from some of these geopolitical tensions where companies are relocating historic manufacturing bases from China to Vietnam. A lot of the Chinese themselves are making significant investments in Vietnam. And I think it's because there's like this fantastic story that you can build around Vietnam. We've always struggled to find high quality companies trading at what we thought were reasonable or low prices. But I guess some of the more recent challenges has created a bit of opportunity for us in that Vietnam has not been a great place to invest over the last 3-4 years on a relative basis. And so we are finding increasingly so the odd counter attractive.
One of the other challenges we face is some of the shares in Vietnam have foreign ownership limits. And some of the ones that we find to be attractive are very close to those limits. So we aren't able to get liquidity in those shares. And within the banking sector as well, we're skeptical of the bad debts reported on some of those banks. And we think that they could need a capital injection in the next few years. And governance has also been a big concern for us on the banking sector. And those views were validated recently with the Saigon Commercial Bank scandal, where a beneficial owner who held something like 90% of the shares in issue was convicted of stealing something like $44 billion from that bank. So we continue to be very cautious on the governance in the banking sector.
Yeah, I read that story. I mean, it's an enormous scandal that unfolded recently.
From a consumer perspective, competition is fantastic. But from an investor perspective, you actually probably prefer a little less competition. So if I can contrast Vietnam with Georgia, in Vietnam, there's roughly 40 banks all competing for the same customers, same consumers. It makes it much more difficult as an outside investor to identify which of those banks do you think are going to be the winners. And also because there's so many banks competing, by and large, it reduces the absolute return on equity that most of those banks can earn. In contrast, Georgia, there's really two banks that dominate in TBC and Bank of Georgia. They've got collectively an 80% market share. And the barriers to entry, I think, for a new bank to come into Georgia are very high, particularly in an economy where the language is different and the overall pie is relatively small. So there's no real incentive for a major global bank to enter Georgia, which makes it more attractive as an investor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe just touching on the attractiveness of the opportunity set. So we, as I highlighted earlier, Frontier was launched just over 7 years ago. Rory, you've been managing a slice since the start. I mean, the outperformance generated versus the benchmark is very pleasing. So it's 5.4% per annum to the end of March. Varshan, as I said, you started managing a slice in 2020. And the 3 and 5 year numbers, if we look at the alpha there, it's sitting at 8%. Is that due to you starting to manage a slice of the fund, the uptick in relative performance?
As much as I would like to take the credit, I think I had a very good starting portfolio thanks to Rory and Nick, who was managing the fund previously. When I look at the valuation of the fund and prospects going forward, a saying that I read about investments, which I think is very relevant, is a perfect world is scary for stocks and a scary world is perfect for stocks. And what does that mean? When we sort of consider the Magnificent Seven stocks listed in the US, they've sort of had a great few years and they're sort of priced for perfection. So any small misstep could lead to poor returns going forward. And a scary world is perfect for stocks. So when we look at the Frontier universe, every day when we come into work, there's some new scandal or some disaster happening in some country. And the effect that that has is share prices tend to move around a lot. There's lots of uncertainty. People don't really know what the earnings prospects are for a lot of these companies. So by doing fundamental research, we have an opportunity to firstly identify stocks that are mispriced and then take advantage of those for our clients. And in terms of prospective returns, when I look across our portfolio, on average, we sort of on 6x forward earnings. The dividend yield on our portfolio is also around 6%. For most of the companies in the fund, we would expect growth in local currency earnings of 10% per annum or better. And many of the currencies have been weak against the dollar over the last few years. So if we have any sort of mean reversion, that would be supportive of returns. And as we've touched on, investor interest is very low in many of these countries. and there have been capital outflows for a number of years. And if that were to reverse, that would be a massive boon for liquidity and demand in these stocks. So I'm quite bullish on the outlook for returns going forward.
The one thing to highlight, I guess, on our performance, both since inception and more recently, is by and large, it's been driven by underlying performance from the company. So there hasn't been a huge improvement in sentiment in these markets, and there hasn't been a significant re-rating in terms of the price people are willing to pay for many of these counters. So, you know, if you ask me what do I think the prospects are over the next 5 or 10 years in Frontier, I'm extremely excited about both absolute returns and our capacity for relative returns. And that's relative returns both versus our local universe, but actually also versus the global kind of world index. And I just want to caveat that is when I think about Frontier markets, I think you need to kind of look at it from almost a private equity lens, in the sense that you're buying these businesses and you intend to own them for a long period in time. So when we make the investment case for a business, it's not predicated on, you know, today I'm buying this company for 4x earnings, and in 4 years' time, I'm going to be able to sell it to someone else for 12 or 13 times earnings. I mean, that would be fantastic. But our base case is that we're going to sell it to someone in 5 or 6 years' time at a similar multiple, and it's going to be the underlying earnings and or dividends that are going to generate the returns for us. And then the second caveat I just want to highlight for anyone who's thinking about investing in Frontier, you know, returns we think are on the outlook is very promising, but it's likely to be volatile. So kind of Varshan alluded to it, is you do tend to get bigger swings in terms of both the kind of the view and the sentiment and the currencies. And so anyone who's thinking about investing, I think you do have to look at it from a very much a long-term perspective and be able to stomach short-term returns that might be, you know, you could see a drawdown of 10, 15, 20% quite easily in any 1 year. And that's not due to any kind of underlying performance issue at the companies. It could just be a swing in sentiment or a view on a particular market or two.
Given the very strong absolute performance that we saw over the past 12 months, you know, 21% in dollars, 30% in rands, you know, what are the prospects looking like going forward? You've highlighted that, you know, the valuations still look very, very cheap and, you know, prospects are good. What do those valuations look like on a comparative basis to our local market, which we analyze extensively, and then versus the developed markets? Just a sense for kind of the valuation differentials.
So the average bank in our fund trades on less than 5x earnings. So I've spoken a little bit about Georgia and Kazakhstan, but then we also own a handful of banks in Nigeria, and those are on kind of 2 to 4x earnings. So Africa, I actually think the banks at this point in time are cheap as well, and they are trading on between 7 and 10x earnings, so roughly double the multiple. And if you look at underlying earnings growth and prospects for earnings growth, I actually think it's much greater in the frontier markets, and that's primarily as a result of, I guess, the maturity of the banking sector. So South Africa's banking sector is much more mature and the prospects for growth are much more limited. And then if you look at the developed world, I mean, so European banks, I guess, have struggled to grow for years and they've got much lower returns on equity than what you'd see in frontier markets, but they typically trade on between kind of 8 and 12x earnings. And then some of the US banks are, you know, on 15, 16, 17x earnings. So much, much greater kind of multiples or expectations priced into those banks. On the consumer-facing stocks, it's a little bit of a different story. So by and large, if there's a nice story around the prospects for growth in frontier markets, you can see quite high multiples on consumer-facing stocks. And those are companies that might sell FMCG products and or retailers that are kind of positioned to benefit from the formalization of retail. At an aggregate level, I think multiples are comparative with what you'd see in more developed markets, but within that, there's massive divergence. And so we've tried to be selective about identifying companies that are trading at a discount. And that could be because there's maybe a view on that particular market, which maybe sentiment is a bit more negative, and or the company's going through 1 or 2 challenges, which can create opportunities for the kind of long-term investor.
Just on those consumer staple stocks, the significant overweight exposure there of 26% of the fund in consumer staples versus 27% versus 6% in the benchmark. Rory touched on, you know, finding some of those opportunities in the Philippine markets. Any other markets where you're finding those consumer staples attractive? And, from a valuation perspective relative to the local market?
So in Vietnam, we identified Masan Consumer, which I mentioned earlier. And in Bangladesh, we have holdings in a company called Olympic Industries. And in Egypt as well, we own shares in a company named Edita Industries. And what do these companies have in common that we like? So there's a high level of management ownership, which provides alignment with shareholders. All of them have grown their earnings in US dollars over a long period of time, and we think they have good prospects to continue to do that. They all operate in countries with large populations where the level of income is rising, which should lead to demand for their products increasing over time. With the last few years, we've seen a lot of inflation and currency weakness in many of these markets. And consumer staples is one of the few sectors that have been able to pass on these increases to their customers. And that's evidenced in their resilient operating margins. And as Rory mentioned earlier, in many of these countries, infrastructure is quite poor. So to develop a distribution network is something that these companies have done over decades. And it's very difficult for new entrants to sort of replicate those networks. So Edita sells sort of confectionaries. So Twinkies is one of their popular products. I tested that one myself. It's excellent. And Olympic Industries in Bangladesh also sells sort of biscuits, cakes, and so on. And Masan Consumer has a wide range of FMCG goods. So things like condiments, spices, sauces, those sorts of things.
So maybe just the last question. Obviously, when constructing portfolios, it's important to think about relative returns. Think what you don't own. So we construct the portfolio from the bottom up, only invest in those opportunities that we think are attractive. If it's trading above what we think is worth, we're not going to own it. What are some of the sectors that we don't have exposure to, given the current valuations?
I think, as you've highlighted, it's dependent on valuation. So there's no one sector or industry that we would say we won't invest in that industry or that sector. But at the moment, we're materially underweight, I would say, telecommunication businesses, real estate, and utilities. So maybe starting with telecommunications, we've actually historically in the fund owned a handful of telco businesses, and by and large, they've actually been poor investments. And one of the things I think we've learned, and this is not unique to Frontier Markets, I think we learned this through looking at the performance of MTN in Africa, is that early on the curve of development in telcos, if you know when you first start getting mobile phone penetration, these are fantastic businesses because your adoption rate is growing rapidly and you're acquiring kind of the high value consumer up front. And so you get very, very strong growth in the early years. Where it is today in most markets, and I mean this goes from the most extreme countries where there's very little like potentially running water or electricity available in remote areas. By and large, people have cell phone towers. So mobile phone penetration in most markets is north of 80%. And many markets of the world, it's well over 100%. And so you've reached saturation. And in most markets now, there's two or three competitors and your number of customers is not growing, which results in competition. And I think particularly so in frontier markets, there's been an element of price gouging where they were charging kind of rates at a material premium to what the true cost of that is. But over time, as they've reached maturity, those prices have come down. So you've got pricing pressure and you're struggling to grow subscribers. So it's not to say we don't own telcos, but we think the multiples didn't justify the underlying fundamentals, at least historically. Real estate, it's a similar story, but it's much more valuation-based. So I think in many of these markets, you could have made a lot of money in real estate, but you really want to have a good understanding of how cities are developing, where the attractive nodes are. And what's happened in quite a few of these markets is the guys that come to market and list real estate businesses have actually already made a substantial portion of money in the private market in those real estate developments. And often what you find is that the share prices trade at a premium to the underlying value of the property, similar to what we saw in South Africa around 2015, 2016, and property's been a pretty dire investment in SA since then. And so I think it's more of us around getting comfort around valuations in real estate. And then the last one, utilities, again, valuation-based. At one point in time, we did actually own Fondul, which was a Romanian company that had a big investment in the local hydropower utility. And we've subsequently sold that after they unbundled it. And utility businesses, you know, they tend to tick along. You kind of lock in decent returns of between 5 and 8% in dollars. And depending on the gearing, we may or may not find that attractive, but it just so happens at this point in time, I think we're finding other counters more attractive.
On the mobile network operators, that is one sector where quite a large proportion of the operating expenses, capital expenditures, and debt is denominated in dollars, whereas all the revenue is denominated in local currency. So we don't like that mismatch. And perhaps on the real estate companies, management of cash flow is quite a big concern, because many of the companies we've looked at sort of reinvest the majority of their profits into larger and more complex projects. And somewhere along the line, you stumble into obstacles and a loss-making project, which often results in balance sheet distress. And because many of those projects are multi-year contracts, it's very difficult to get comfort around the revenue recognition of those companies. So that's an added complexity when looking at the real estate sector.
Just the last question for both of you. Traveling to see various interesting countries, which countries have surprised you the most?
I find all of them interesting for different reasons. And one of the great kind of benefits of being involved in this fund is you go to quite a few countries that you wouldn't necessarily go to purely for tourism reasons. So, I mean, Vietnam is a fantastic country to visit, both from a tourist and an investor perspective. A lot is happening. I mean, the thing that stands out for me the most is just the traffic. It's incredible in the sense that they've got scooters and motorbikes, which must be about 70 to 80% of the traffic on the road. And to the outside observer, it looks like traffic lights are more a suggestion than a rule. So crossing the road can be quite a challenge. But I mean, that's the food there is amazing. The people are really great. And then, you know, I've been to Pakistan. Again, you kind of get a lot more insight into what it's like to be on the ground than what maybe your external perception is. And I found the people there actually very warm and friendly as well. So that was a really nice surprise for me. And Georgia also stood out for me as a country, you know, you wouldn't necessarily go to, but when you get there, productive, hardworking, intelligent people, the food is very good.
Sri Lanka stands out for me, particularly from a value perspective. You're not going to get much more value for your lands. And the sites are amazing as well, and the people are very friendly. And please support John Keels if you are visiting Sri Lanka.
And drink lime beer.
So that brings us to the end of episode 18. Thank you, Rory and Vashon, for joining us. As contrarian investors, we are always willing to explore areas of markets that may not be the most popular, but offer us the opportunity to find compelling ideas for our clients. In this conversation, we discuss frontier markets and the broad opportunity set they offer, within which there are a basket of high-quality companies with good earnings growth prospects and low starting valuations. Frontier markets also offer exposure to industries that are not necessarily available on the local market, such as uranium miners. In closing, frontier exposure is well worth considering as a small allocation of a diversified investment portfolio. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@allengray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Allen Gray is an authorized financial services provider. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Grant Pitt. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.